This is GamesAtWork.biz with Phaedra Boinodiris, Michael Martin, and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone, and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 164, Addictive AR. Hello and welcome again, for those of you who are coming back, to another edition of GamesAtWork.biz. This is Michael Martin. I am very pleased to be joining my friend and co-host, Mr. Michael Rowe, for what we believe to be maybe our best episode ever.
The best ever.
Certainly
and
the best.
Welcome to all the new listeners.
On the 3rd of March. Yes, and welcome to all the new listeners, too. So, come on in. There's room down front. You know, we'll get you all set. So we're going to start talking right up front about room down front from the perspective of augmented reality. And there's a really cool blog post that I saw earlier this week about a company called Striker that's using the Microsoft HoloLens environment to take advantage of augmented reality to bring all the necessary parties who should be part of an operating room theater engagement to the operating room with a front row first-hand viewpoint, leveraging the augmented reality headset from Microsoft. And I thought this was pretty clever and does realize, you know, one of the areas that is most promising in terms of being able to see through layers of data or bring layers of data up and make them more visible for people who are performing crucial tasks like an operation on a human being.
I thought this was a great blog post, and it's actually from the Microsoft blog site for HoloLens. So I think it's Lorraine, can't remember her last name, but
Bardeen.
She's one of the product managers for the team.
GM for the experiences. That's absolutely right.
Yeah. So she works on it. So this is definitely really cool. Definitely recommend you watch the video. I did find it interesting. And having not gotten my hands on HoloLens yet, but I like the idea that the whole headset is wireless, so you're not tethered, which is a big difference from things like Oculus Rift or even the leaked pictures from Magic Leap, which we know is still in development and is not publicly available yet. But I was paying attention when they're in the operating room simulation, laying out the operating room, on the UI gestures that they were using, right? How were they actually manipulating the space? Obviously, what we saw watching the video was a video overlay of what the people in the room were experiencing, because the camera was not seen from the view of a person in the room.
Right.
The transition from looking at an overview of the operating theater that they were designing to the, okay, now you stepped into it. This is where the surgical bed is. These are where some of the other equipment pieces are, etc. And that transition, I thought that was really cool. It did look like the physics simulation was strictly placement. I didn't see much movement of things in the virtual or augmented operating room to give you any sense of physics, but just the fidelity and the experience that these people were all having in the same physical space with the same overlay of a virtual or augmented space, I thought that was really cool.
Well, I did as well, and maybe I leapt a little too far ahead into the space two of the virtual reality version of this, which I could see as an interesting overlay too. So it's not just the design of the operating theater and making sure that you have the physical proximity of all the pieces and parts and equipment where you needed them, But I could also see where you could leverage this from a VR perspective too, and be able to bring in expertise as you needed them on an on-demand fashion, that they could have a perspective of the operating room, table, the patient, the equipment all around it that they couldn't physically do if they were in the theater and needing to have that necessary elbow space, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That's another good point. Just like you, my brain jumped to other extensions of the use case. So, mm-hmm. for example, with highly precise robotic remote surgery capabilities, giving the remote physician the ability to sense the operating room as if they were standing there is another use case that I think that would be really cool, right? So if I'm controlling a remote robotic arm because I can't make it to the physical surgery location, but I'm doing it as if I'm looking down at the patient in real time right in front of me, I think that's a really cool extension of this. As well, they had a second video in the article about some work that they're doing with Case Western University. And
right.
kind of, there's an anatomy app that I remember on the iPad. It's on Mac and Windows and lots of different platforms. And they show how this could be rendered in a mixed or augmented reality space so that this one medical student was able to, for the first time, see one of the major arteries around the heart in position with everything else on the body in three-dimensional space, right? Not just reading it in the book. So I can imagine I'm a surgeon. I'm in the middle of an actual surgery with a physical patient in front of me, and I need to look up placement of something, calling up a augmented version of that patient, you know, 3 feet left of the table, and then say, okay, remove the skin, remove the muscle tissue. I want to see exactly nerve structure based off of the MRI that we did.
That would be just really, really, really cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be really, really cool.
You can kind of see how the simple use case that they describe in the article, which was just, let's set up a new surgical procedure room and have a cross-disciplinary team all physically co-located and see how it might look, right? To all these additional use cases that it logically extends to. Very, very cool.
Right. And being able to, you know, potentially do something like you could remove the heart virtually and have that be showing near the patient, but within the line of sight, you know, essentially a head-up display of critical body functions that you can easily glance over, and you're not trying to look at a different machine. You know, you see where it is, you see how it's operating, you see if there might be problems that are happening and complications from the operation in progress, and be able to do something around fixing those while it's going on. So lots of interesting elements use case wise, and in my mind, and I think this is where you are too, Michael, is a blending, right, of the mixed reality uses to allow the expertise to be right there as it's needed on that demand, even if they're not physically in the room, and for the people physically in the room to have even a broader peripheral understanding of what's going on for that patient within easy eyesight and not requiring lots of head turning to go look at machines or hear or sense something else that might be going wrong.
Exactly.
Well, cool. So that gets us as a start, and to take us a layer deeper in our Grey's Anatomy book here of virtual and mixed reality, there was a fantastic article from The Guardian, rather long one. So if you're going to take a read of this, and I suggest you do, curl up, grab a book, a nice cup of coffee here to take a read of, maybe not a book, but for this particular
article. Yeah, you probably don't want to grab a book because then you won't be reading this.
Yeah, you won't be reading this because it is a bit long. But it does talk about a number of topics that, Michael, you and I have been discussing for a while, namely the endorphins that get released and get people continuing to play games and being engaged in the games, and really linking that nicely to the virtual and VR technology too, AR, VR technology that's coming into play. that people are more engaged. They're getting something more out of the environment, and their intention is being held for longer, and that it keeps them from changing into something different. I particularly like the Tetris example as I was going through this, because I do remember playing a lot of Tetris when I was when Tetris first came out. Let's just put it that way.
Back before you were born.
I never ever played Candy Crush, though. Did you ever play Candy Crush?
No, but there are so many games in that same vein. Oh God, what was the one that I played with just a little bit to see what it was like? There was a Futurama game. And basically it's Candy Crush, right? There were so many of these games, but they're basically, do you remember the children's game, physical game, Connect Four?
Yes.
That's what it is.
Yes.
That's what it is. Except instead of getting rid of the whole game when you finally connect four and going to the next level, it gets rid of those pieces and everything else drops.
Yeah, allowing you to continue playing.
And the interesting thing about that, and the way this article is written, and the stuff that you and I have been talking about literally for years, is in the addictive quality, right? In the sense that you want to make a game or a experience provide a, I'm going to use the term, an unexpected positive feedback. So if you always did the same things and always got the same feedback, over time, the amount of dopamine that's generated in the brain will drop. They did this experiment with pellets of food for pigeons, right? You hit the button, you get food. You hit the button, you get food. And over time, the pigeons just know it, and it's not as positive as a reinforcement, as if you hit the button, you get food, you hit the button, you don't get food, you hit the button again, you don't get food, and you randomize the feedback of the food, and so the experience becomes more pleasurable when it occurs, and the monotony and boredom part just becomes a kind of an ingrained reaction, right? And so the author really says how these games do that. And even Tetris, you get the positive feedback when you match up the line blinks for a second and highlights, disappears. And the way he said it was really telling to me. And he goes, and then all you are left with are your mistakes. So if you think about it, there's this huge amount of negative reinforcement. Oh, look at all those blocks that are stacking up because you couldn't clear the row.
Sure.
And so when you think about the types of experiences that people are looking at in games within augmented reality, when you think about the physics of what is, not the physics, but the aesthetics and the functionality of an appropriately working operating room, how do you provide that positive dopamine feedback to the people designing the operating theater? Do you do that by having a set of observers, potential practitioners or patients, and when they see something pleasing, you provide feedback to the people in the augmented space? Maybe that's a way to do kind of design thinking and improving your designs.
It could very well be, and that clicks kind of nicely to the part of the article here that's talking about how Facebook added the experiment of the like button.
Yes.
And what that did for them. So you could imagine where your instant feedback here would be to allow for likes to come from the people that you're designing for. And, well, you know, that would tap into that very, very natural space, right?
Yeah, and there was another part of the article, and I can't remember the actual researcher who did something with that with Instagram, where he actually put a bot out there that just liked everything.
Yeah, that was there was a web developer named Ramit Chawla.
Yeah, and it caused people.
He did something called Lovematically. Right?
That's it, Lovematically.
It automatically liked things.
Yeah, and you find out that if you like things, people are more likely to like back.
Right.
And so
right.
by just automating the likes, it was causing huge positive feedback for people and building these networks. And then he got shut down for violating terms of service.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So
because it was taking away the dopamine drip, if you think about it, because it's if everything's liked, the dopamine is less. He's giving away the dopamine for free.
I don't think that's why they shut him down. I think they shut him down because it was an automated tool doing this sort of thing, right?
Well, you know? The way he put it is, using drug terminology, you know, Instagram is the dealer and I'm the new guy in the market giving away the drug for free.
Yeah, I mean, he is, but I read that too and I thought, well, you know, the gaming of the Instagram game here is like what you said. I like something, so therefore it is more likely that someone will like me back. How's that for using the word like about six times?
I like it.
I was enjoying it myself. But that's kind of where I was kind of parked was he was gaming the system to generate more likes for his material because he was liking everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't use this bot, so I don't know exactly how it would, you know, how it would work. But I catch myself, too, checking to see, hey, I got some likes for this post. And isn't that cool? And now I feel good about it. Right.
Yeah. I don't like any of the likes that I like on my like posts.
Yeah. So long story short, this particular article from The Guardian, if we read about it, the bottom of it says it's an adapted text of Irresistible by a guy named Adam Alter, which is a book that's being published 2nd of March. That was yesterday in the UK and on the 7th in the US. So that could be rather interesting to pick up. So if you find this interesting, there's not just an article, there is a book behind it.
Cool.
Very cool. All right. So moving along, like I said, best show ever, or at least best show today.
Number one.
Number one. There was an experience I had just yesterday coming to the airport in New York and flying home. And I took an Uber and I saw something on the dashboard of this Uber and I thought, oh, that's pretty interesting. I kind of watched it a little bit and it's called Mobileye. And this Mobileye device is this small round display which shows a car, little green car, and it shows two lanes, you know, or two lines representing the lane the car is driving on. And I was watching it, and at first I thought there was some interaction between the cell phone and this little Mobileye device because when they were using Waze, the driver was using Waze, I saw the speed limit show up in Waze, and I saw a little speed limit sign show up in that little circular thing, too, that matched it. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. And I saw it beep or heard it beep when a lane departure happened, you know, so you're driving like a little bit too, you know, straddling a lane marker. And I saw different numbers showing up for the car. So like 1.0, 1.6, 2.0 as the car as this device was recognizing distance between itself and the car in front of it. So saw all this stuff. And I asked about it. It's like, well, this looks pretty interesting. So what's the story here? Well, it was part of the rental fleet because my driver was just sort of trying out whether she wanted to continue being an Uber driver or not. So this was her first foray. And she had a car that she was renting from a service to provide cars to Uber drivers to drive around. So interesting point number one.
Starting to slice up that value chain, aren't they?
Yeah, a little bit, right? So you're not using your own car. You're renting a car in order to provide transportation services. So I thought that was an interesting slice just for that. But then I thought to myself too, okay, well, you're probably embedding in that rental experience maintenance, you're embedding insurance, you're embedding a bunch of stuff, you know, harkening back to our show from last week, Michael. And this particular device is like, well, how is this working? And what real value is it providing the driver? So it's an augmented driving experience where there are sensors that are connected to it to sense distance between the car in front of you and lanes and speed limits. And I couldn't figure out exactly how it was all working, but there seemed to be this, I don't know, a little larger than a pack of cards thing that was behind the rearview mirror facing out. You know, so I was guessing that's where there's some camera. to notice what were the road conditions, distance to the car, lanes, da 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 da, and then it was connected via cable to this little round display. So you and I had a little chat about this before the show, and I can see where this is certainly an aid to a driver, like a drowsy driver that might be needing to know, hey, I'm starting to weave across my lanes, and, you know, alert me before I do something that could be potentially dangerous to myself and my passengers. So good for that. Could be good to remind the driver what the speed limit is at a particular point on the highway, because they don't show that all the time. Certainly could be good about providing appropriate distancing, because sometimes when you're driving at speed, it's a little difficult to tell, am I the requisite number of seconds behind the car in front of me, and do I have enough room? But the flip of all this is, you imagine it's watching and recording and probably reporting too, maybe on the driver and the quality of their driving.
Absolutely. Right? Especially if this is an aftermarket accessory added into the vehicle, which it obviously looks like. You and I talked about this, that the, what is it, the EDR has been in cars since like 2014, 96% of all vehicles on the road had this in the car, right? So the EDR being the event data recorder. Think of it like the black box that's happening in airplanes. It doesn't transmit this data, but when you start buying a service by a third party to provide basically LiDAR and radar capability and cameras to be able to do recognition of speed limit signs, recognition of the distance between your car and the car in front of you, identification of the painted lines on the road so it can do lane detection, all of that requires a significant amount of horsepower. Some of that information it'll get from the cloud, which means it's connected. Some of it gets from the vehicle. Some of it gets from maps in order to provide you that feedback as the driver. Just like, you know, many kind of mid-range and higher cars now, at least for the last 3 or 4 years, have had driver assist or lane assist or adaptive cruise control. All of those are using the same technology that provides that awareness of where the vehicle is on the road in relationship to other vehicles on the road and the conditions of the road. So once you have the data and you're providing it as a service, you want to improve your service. So you want to improve your drivers. You want to take that data and potentially crunch it and provide better adaptive algorithms for autonomous vehicles or driver assist vehicles, et cetera. So the data is collected, whether or not it is currently being used to single out you as a driver, who knows?
Well, you made another point that I think is pretty important in the pre-show, Michael, too, that the data is really what's valuable. Even if it's not individualized, if you aggregate the data, it provides an enormous body of insight that's available to autonomous driving decision making.
Yeah,
right?
That's what I just mentioned about the ability to augment and improve the algorithms, right?
Yeah. And apologies there. I must have spaced on that particular thing because that was where I thought the there could be an enormous value that's generated from that, because then you can try out different scenarios using real data, real insight, and you could virtually model what a car might do based on the algorithms that are there.
Yep.
Yeah. No. That makes perfect sense. So,
but it's really cool that you saw it in action. I noticed that Waze for some times has had the little pop-up, as you said. This is the posted speed limit. This is the speed limit you are at.
Well, right. And Waze, I think, knows that because of data that has been provided into it. So let's just say that a highway is normally 65 miles an hour, and temporarily, it's down to 55 because it's in a work zone now, right?
So yeah, it'll Waze get that wrong most of the time.
Right. It wouldn't have a chance to get that. But if you had paired it up with something like this, then theoretically, if this device is recognizing what the speed limit is because of some sort of visual indicator, you know, it's reading the signs, then it could turn and flip that data into a service like Waze or others.
Yeah. Very cool.
So very cool stuff. All right. Well, we are nearly at time, and there was one other aspect here that I wanted to kind of get into the mix, and that was dealing with Xperia. So Sony has a new device that's coming out here with a screen that was the starting point that is even better than what people normally see on television. And it was a little bit further in this article that you came across something that you thought, hey, this is pretty darn clever. So I had had problems reloading this article. So I wanted to see if you remember, oh, look at this. It's finally coming up again. Hey, hooray. So remind me what it was.
Yeah. There was a section way at the bottom of the article that was talking about the touch projector.
Right, right.
And they had a really nice little video of doing a math game with three participants sitting around the table. And it got me thinking about a little device that I have sitting right here called the Magic Cube. And the Magic Cube was, it still is because it works, and I just tested it out before the show. It's a laser-based keyboard. So it's a Bluetooth device. It's a little cube. You hook it up to your cell phone or your iPad or your tablet or your laptop or your desktop, as long as they have Bluetooth. And it puts a keyboard on a flat surface for you. And as you type, the fact that your fingers break the laser points that are mapping out the keyboard, it becomes a keyboard.
Nice.
Yeah. And so what I saw in their demo, now, it was much more colorful, much more detailed looking, but they were still doing very large numbers that were being tapped or sliced through in order to answer the math questions. So one of the things that this is a Celluon Magic Cube. One of the things that I've had as a challenge with it, I won't say issue because I don't use it enough, is that the fidelity is not very high. And so you really have to kind of type with your hands above the keyboard and your hands flopping down from your wrist, so it's very obvious where you are typing. Right. Compared to a normal keyboard where your wrists are probably on the wrist guard or on the table and you're just typing, right? So it's a little bit awkward that way, but for something really cool at a demo or in a dark room, or, you know, you just want to look like some spy in a spy movie, and this device actually was used in a computer hacker movie. I mean, not my personal one, but the same technology. It looks cool and it's kind of fun.
Neat. Well, cool. Well, I'm glad I managed to get this thing back on my screen and that you remembered the piece that you wanted to show too. So I think that's where we're going to leave the show for today. So we hope that you've enjoyed it today. We hope that it's given you some things to think about. If you've got a few things you'd like us to think about and us to chat about, you know how to reach us. We're on all the channels that you normally can imagine, on Instagram and on Twitter and on Facebook and more and more and more. So please do reach out, share with us what you think, and we'll be happy to discuss them here on our next gamesatwork.biz.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
See ya.
You've been listening to gamesatwork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.